that hopey changey stuff working out for you?
Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, you are coming to us today from remote North Potomac, Maryland. Could you explain to us why?
Because I can't stop watching the Sarah Palin Tea Party speech over and over. I can't leave my house.
You can't leave long enough to take a little metro ride down here into the District of Columbia where we have 3 feet of snow.
I cannot get out of my street.
Well, you know, Ken, you've had this problem for years. Yeah. I don't know why it has to focus on this particular week.
Oh, please. I'd rather talk to you and the people on the podcast than do this every day. I've been sitting here for a week.
And, of course, we do miss having you in the newsroom. But, Ken, tell me, how is that Hopi change stuff working out for you?
Well, I don't know much about Indian tribes, but it seems like Sarah Palin did excite the crowd in Nashville. I don't know if she excited the Republicans nationwide.
She excited the crowd in St. Paul, and now she's excited the crowd in Nashville. And those were not necessarily Republicans she was talking to in Nashville.
No, and that's exactly it. We are misinterpreting the Tea Party if we think this is just an outgrowth of the Republican Party. This is a parole/disaffection that's out there in politics. Yes, it's probably more conservative. It's probably leaning more Republican, but you'll see it's not the kind of Republicans like Charlie Crist. It's not the kind of Republicans that you'll see in many other parts of the country. It's a certain brand of Republicanism that I think establishment Republicans may not be so happy to embrace when it comes to November or the primaries.
But they would be more than glad to have these people's votes in November, because presumably, while they may be disruptive in terms of Republican primaries for some establishment Republican candidates, they will not be Democratic votes under any circumstances.
Right, but it's very possible that they could be a force in the Republican Party and have nominees come out so conservative that the moderates, the middle-of-the-road voters, may not be so inclined to vote Republican in November, even though the polls show they're inclined to do so right now.
I'm curious as to where this movement is going, though, because we had this meeting in Nashville. About 600 people showed up, paid $550 each to attend the convention, somewhat less just to come hear Sarah Palin on Saturday night. The group had a relatively uneventful meeting. There were some other controversial speakers, Tom Tancredo and so on. But they did not really make a lot of news other than to have this one well-paid speaker who got a pretty good public relations hit out of it, although she's also gotten pretty badly beaten up by an awful lot of commentators, critics, comics, people making fun of her having crib notes written on her hand. There's a new poll out from ABC News and the Washington Post that shows her unfavorable number is much higher than it's been before. It's all the way up to 55%. Her favorable number is down to 37%. That's the first time I've ever seen a poll with Sarah Palin under 40% approval.
My problem with the crib note, let me start quickly with the crib notes thing. The same people who were jumping on Sarah Palin over the crib notes are the same people who said, boy, why are we focusing on John Edwards' haircut? That's so trivial. It is
they
trivial.
Are. Are they the exact same people?
Some of them are older. They're like 2 years
They're older now, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Look, I think it's silly, just like the Obama teleprompter story was silly. This is just ridiculous. But it's not just the liberal media and Democrats who are disenchanted with Sarah Palin. It's Republicans, too, who are having second thoughts about her. She does give a good speech. I think it's a mistake to underestimate the potency of the Tea Party people, but I don't know if Sarah Palin is more than just a flavor of the month, the flavor of the year that will not translate into electoral success for the Republicans.
We have a number of commentators now suddenly writing columns about how Sarah Palin could become the voice of populism, conservative populism, if you will, in America over the next couple of years and emerge as a serious candidate for president. Now, I think you and I agree that she isn't making the moves she should be making if she really does want to organize a serious campaign. But what if she just were to become, in a sense, carried on the shoulders of a movement of people just demanding that she run? She told Fox News she'd be willing.
I agree with you completely. I mean, if you're Tim Pawlenty, you do need to organize a political action committee, start to talk to people in Iowa, New Hampshire, organize, hire a staff. But if you're Sarah Palin, everybody knows who she is, for better or worse. I don't think if Sarah Palin is thinking of 2012, deciding what to do in February 2010. I don't think you have to do that yet. I think she has plenty of time, but I don't know if her numbers will get better.
Regardless of whether you'd vote for her, do you think Palin is qualified or not qualified to be president? The answer to that question, she is all the way down to 26% of the people in the country saying qualified. That's the lowest it's ever been. It's dropped 12 points since last November.
Right, and just because the Democratic numbers are not doing so well right now, that doesn't mean it'll be the same case in 2012. Just go back to 1994. The Democrats were on the run. Bill Clinton's numbers were down. Democrats paid the price in November of 1994, losing the House and the Senate. But Clinton was able, adeptly able, to use the Republican takeover of Congress to his advantage in 1996 and won re-election. It's very possible that if the Republicans do make significant gains in 2010 in November, and right now it looks like they might, I could very well see very astute President Obama using the Republican gains and whatever they represent to re-election in 2012. Of course, we're talking about 3 years away. It's a lifetime away.
And I suspect that before we get there, there are going to be some enormous things that hit us like this snowstorm and that change everything and change the landscape and make us wonder why we had any of those silly opinions we had beforehand. But we can only deal with the information we have before us at the moment. That same poll that I was referring to earlier shows President Obama at 51% approval. That's approximates the lowest he has been so far in his presidency. That includes a disapproval number of 46%, which is the highest it's ever been. And of that 46, 33 percentage points are people who strongly disapprove. So he is truly building up a cadre of opponents, much like George W. Bush did in his second term, of people who are virulently opposed to what he's doing. And that's going to drive a lot of the energy of this midterm election.
And I think that same generic Republican who's doing so well against Harry Reid in Nevada could be the same generic Republican who beats Obama in 2012.
We've already seen, of course, we've talked a lot about the November elections in New Jersey and Virginia. We've talked a lot about Massachusetts. There have been some other special elections we haven't talked so much about over the course of the last year in state legislative races around the country. And about a dozen seats have changed hands from Democratic to Republican in those special elections since President Obama took office.
You know, Ron, what people are not taking into account, and there's just two words, demon sheep.
Yes, I think it's time that we take this to the four-legged level. What exactly is going on out in California, Ken?
Tom Campbell. Is he what he tells us? Or is he what he's become over the years? A FCINO, fiscal conservative in name only. A wolf in sheep's clothing.
This is the most amazing ad I have ever seen in my life.
Now, let's make it clear, this is not an ad. It's not on television.
No, but it's on the internet. It's gone viral, and I think...
What do we call this? It's a hit piece on the internet.
It's a 3-minute and 22-second ad put out by Carly Fiorina, who once upon a time was the Republican frontrunner for the Senate race in California. Somehow, the frontrunner is now Tom Campbell. Tom Campbell was the finance director under Arnold Schwarzenegger. Anybody who wants to brag that he was a finance director, given what's going on in California, is pretty amazing.
Yeah, but isn't that like being the United States, Secretary of Treasury or being the chairman of the board of the Federal Reserve? I mean, those are responsible jobs of people who are trying to deal with a difficult situation. And why wouldn't the same be true for the finance director for the governor of California?
One of the reasons that Governor Schwarzenegger's numbers are so poor is because of the state of the economy in California. It's bad everywhere.
Yeah, but that's not Tom Campbell's fault anymore than it's Carly Fiorina's fault.
But it is, if you look at Carly Fiorina's ad, and which is so bizarre.
But the sheep. Let's talk about the sheep.
I think what's really important is the fact that it's just not even a clever, effective ad. It's probably, Campbell says it's made him raise more money than ever. It's brought him more money.
It is the strangest thing, because there are some real sheep, and then there is this devil sheep with
the wolf
red
in sheep's clothing
eyes.
By the way, it's a good thing we're talking about this, because I got this note. You know, I write this blog, Political Junkie. I don't know if you know about this.
Oh, is that you?
You can see the ad. But anyway, I got this email from Buddy Bradley, who says, this is what he says, please discuss in your next podcast about the demon sheep ad. I expect a few zany, pun-filled zingers from you, Ken, and wry but insightful comments from Ron. What's
Ron?
That all about?
Is that the other guy? Okay, so once again, though, we have the question of, we know television ads work. We know television ads can hammer somebody's positive numbers down. We know that positive television ads can help people. What about these internet viral hit pieces that are going back and forth between these campaigns? Is that for anyone other than political junkies?
No, but of course, if the primary is in June, I think the only people paying attention right now are political junkies. But everyone is talking about this ad. And there's some people who think perhaps maybe Carly Fiorina is crazy like a fox in the fact that everybody is talking about it and it'll give her some attention. But I think this is what the problem with a first-time candidate is, that you need to know what works and doesn't work. There's something refreshing about a novice candidate, but when it's so out of the ballpark like this one, you wonder whether this is the person who could really lead the party to victory in November.
Well, that's right, Ken. Crazy like a fox in sheep's clothing, perhaps. We've had a lot of other primary news already. Illinois had the nation's first primary, maybe flew under the radar a little bit for a lot of people in the first week of February when then the big snow hit. But we did get an interesting result in Illinois, which has already been, I believe, obviated. Is this not right?
Well, we've talked about the Illinois Senate race many times. Mark Kirk is the Republican nominee. Alexei Janulius, the state treasurer, is a Democratic nominee, and that's going to be one that everybody will watch. There's also a gubernatorial primary. Pat Quinn barely won the Democratic nomination over his challenger. The Republican nominee is still yet to be decided. It's a 400-vote difference between the top two Republicans. But the weirdest thing of all is the Democratic primary for lieutenant governor.
That is indeed strange, because the candidate there was essentially repudiated by his would-be running mate, Pat Quinn, who said, I don't particularly want to run with this guy. He's got some kind of problem with his wife.
Well, it wasn't even his wife. Scott Lee Cohn is a Democrat, spent $2 million of his own money to win the nomination. He did allude to some domestic incident with his then-girlfriend during the primary, but it came out after he won that he basically assaulted her, and it just also so happens that his ex-girlfriend was a prostitute. Of course, Scott Lee Cohn's words were, I thought she was a massage therapist. I've been using that excuse for years. It doesn't work for me. It didn't work for Scott Lee Cohn, and 5 days later, he was out of the race.
Hey, and speaking of connections to prostitutes, why don't we go back to the wonderful state of New York, where you could catch us up on the latest in that soap opera that began there with Governor Spitzer.
Well, Governor Spitzer resigned in March of 2008 over his involvement in a prostitution scandal. And here we have David Paterson, the lieutenant governor, moving up to the governorship. His numbers have been abysmal from day one. He's an accidental governor who can't deal with the state legislature. But almost surreally, the past couple of weeks, New York politicos have been
a buzz.
A buzz is the word, about with a rumored New York Times hit piece on either whether the governor did drugs or had an affair or kidnapped the Lindbergh baby.
And this has been reported in every news organization in New York except the New York Times.
That's what's so bizarre about this. It's a rumor, and yet when Governor Paterson holds a press conference to denounce rumors,
he denounces the New York Times.
And it suddenly becomes a story. So while we don't like to traffic about rumors, especially about you, Ron, and you know who, so we won't even talk about that. But when Governor Paterson dignifies rumors by holding a press conference denouncing the New York Times, it suddenly becomes a story. And it's one more thing that shows that Paterson is not long for this job.
Yes, but Ken, now that you're talking about New York, what's going on with Hiram Montserrat?
Hiram Montserrat, we talked about in a podcast last year. He was one of the two Democrats who bolted to the Republican Party.
I love that word, bolted. It's never used for anything but people who switch political parties.
But Hiram Montserrat also, even before he briefly switched parties, because a few weeks later he went back to the Democrats, he was accused of dragging his girlfriend and cutting her with glass. And of course, in the interim, if he had been convicted of a felony, he would have been automatically expelled from the state Senate. He was only convicted of assault, which is a misdemeanor. I guess when you assault a woman with glass, it's only a misdemeanor. Explain that to me.
I don't understand it.
But anyway, the state Senate voted 53-8 to expel him from the Senate for the first New York State lawmaker expelled since 1861. And back then, they didn't even have glass. And right now, the Democrats now have a 31-30 majority in the state Senate. You can't do anything without 32 votes. So good for them. I mean, the Democrats may have hurt their own cause by losing a crucial vote, but they did the right thing in expelling Montserrat. Governor Paterson said there'll be a special election in March.
All right. A lot of ugly stories, a lot of ugly stories about politicians and mistreating their friends. We did have one exceptionally happy story for one city in America over the past week. That was, of course, the surprise Super Bowl victory for New Orleans, Louisiana.
We are the Cougars! 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 Cougars!
came at exactly the same time, on exactly the same weekend, that they were electing a new mayor and not necessarily a new name.
Well, the name is familiar. It's Mitch Landrieu. He's lieutenant governor, a longtime lieutenant governor, the brother of Senator Mary Landrieu. Maybe even more important, the son of Moon Landrieu, who was the last white mayor of New Orleans. He left office in 1978. Mitch Landrieu, by his victory, his overwhelming victory on last Saturday, among whites and blacks alike, Mitch Landrieu becomes the first white mayor of New Orleans in 32 years.
Yeah, and without throwing any further aspersions on Ray Nagin, who is the exiting mayor, he was term limited. He couldn't run again, so he wasn't being directly defeated here. He obviously had to steer New Orleans through some of the worst years in its history, if not the very worst years in its history. And as he goes out the door, the city gets a chance to start over again with somebody who, as you said, won a biracial majority and also comes in on the absolute wing lift of this fabulous victory for the Saints and a wonderful opportunity for the city to have a happy parade and celebrate itself for the first time in a long time.
You know, 4 years ago, Mitch Landrieu lost to Ray Nagin, who's, of course, he was term limited this time, but Ray Nagin was reelected 4 years ago, not because he did such a great job with Hurricane Katrina, and most people felt he didn't, but they just liked him more than Mitch Landrieu. In the intervening 4 years, I think Nagin's numbers went really, really down, and Mitch Landrieu gets a second chance out of that, especially looking at the size of his victory on Saturday.
As we bid farewell to Ray Nagin, we are also bidding farewell to a couple of medium well-known congresspersons, people who have been around for a while. Representative Vern Ehlers from the Grand Rapids, Michigan district, made famous by Jerry Ford back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And also Diane Watson from Southern California, from Los Angeles. And they are both the exact same age, 76 years old, and both deciding they've had enough of Congress and they're not going to seek another term.
And third name to that list, Mario Diaz-Balart, the Cuban-American from South Florida, also announced his retirement. Three members of Congress, not household names, but three names who will not return for the next Congress.
Curiously, the number of Republicans retiring continues to exceed the number of Democrats retiring, and that's something of a surprise in a year when you would think the Republicans were really feeling their oats and on their big march back.
I think that's true, and it's also true in the Senate. There were six open seats on the Senate side by the Republicans, four on the Democratic side, and yet everybody seems to make a bigger deal over the Democrats, maybe because the tide theoretically seems to be turning against the Democrats, and people are watching and trying to compare it possibly to 1994. But you make a good point. There are also a lot of Republican open seats that the GOP are going to have to defend.
And frequently at the end of a podcast, we say goodbye to a member who has passed in the week before, a member of Congress or another famous political figure. This week, we possibly could have begun the podcast, really, by talking about the passing of John Murtha and Charlie Wilson, two Democrats who were about the same age, who served in many of the same years in the Democratic majorities of the past generation, and who, in a sense, embodied two kinds of typical Democrat through that long period of Democratic domination.
John Murtha may have been one of the most powerful members of Congress. We hear that adjective used over and over again, but with Murtha, it was definitely true. He was nationally known when he was elected because he was elected in February of 1974 when everybody was looking to see if the Watergate scandal would become a crippling blow to the Republicans in the 1974 elections. When Murtha won the Republican seat in February of 74, people said, uh-oh, bad news for the Republicans.
He was a bellwether.
It was exactly
36 years ago this month.
That's right. And Murtha was the longest serving House member in Pennsylvania history. But more importantly, when he started off early on the Appropriations Committee, played a big role with veterans benefits, with supporting Pentagon policies, even though he didn't make many House speeches on the House floor, his influence was tremendous. His ability to get pork to his Johnstown district in the western part of Pennsylvania was legendary. He did get national attention again, unfortunately for him, in 1980 during the Abscam scandal when he was rumored to be involved, although he was never indicted.
John Murtha really came to symbolize the pro-defense, hawkish Democrat who was a two-term Marine. He was in the Korean era. Then he was a highly decorated Vietnam veteran.
The first Vietnam veteran ever elected to
Congress.
That's
right. And certainly somebody who came to personify the idea of the United States Marine Corps on the floor of the United States Congress. But late in his career, he gained a new and different notoriety when he turned against the Iraq War. He had initially voted for it, but by 2005, he felt that the whole mission had been botched and misconceived, and he was calling it all based on an illusion and giving some of the most trenchant arguments and speeches against the Iraq War that we heard from any Democrat.
That 2005 speech was a sea change in the way everybody saw John Murtha. Certainly the progressives, he became a hero, and the thought of the progressives seeing John Murtha as a hero is just mind-boggling, but that's exactly what happened.
You know, and here we got to talk about Charlie Wilson, too, because Charlie Wilson came from, in a sense, the opposite side of the Democratic spectrum in some respects. Murtha was from the North, from a pro-union background, from an industrial background. Charlie Wilson comes from Texas. He's
East Texas.
Absolute personification of the good old boy. He was a guy who loved the high life, made infamous, really, as the symbol of a certain kind of congressional high living in the movie Charlie Wilson's War, where we see him portrayed humorously, really, and in a friendly sort of way by Tom Hanks. But they're certainly not making him out to be anybody's idea of a paragon of public virtue. And he then gets religion, as it were, over the whole project of Afghanistan. This is in the 1980s, you understand, not the current situation in Afghanistan, where the Russians were occupying the country, and Charlie Wilson got interested in providing armaments to the Mujahideen, the people who were trying to throw the Russians out, and some of whom are still there trying to throw us out.
Everybody in Washington knew who Charlie Wilson was for the longest time. He was the good times Charlie, the women. Any time anybody walked into his congressional office in the Rayburn House building, there was one stunning woman after another, and that's what he was known for. He lived it. He loved it. He had a great time with it. But as you say, he was also a very serious lawmaker. The fact that he felt very strongly about the Afghan rebels fighting the then Soviet occupation of Afghanistan, that drove him. And that's basically what led to that 2007 movie, Charlie Wilson's War.
John Murtha, 76, Charlie Wilson, 77, both leaving us this week. That's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. When I die.